Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by our show sponsor, Explorer Risk Medical. Explorer offer unique CPD adventures for paramedics, nurses, and doctors. You can learn about altitude, dive, tropical, or remote medicine while exploring some of the most picturesque locations in the world. So if you want to take your CPD out of the classroom and on an adventure, head to their website, www.explorerriskmedical.org. Now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. It's going to be our last or our final podcast for 2023, and we have a very special guest on today to wrap up the year. But first, Sonny, you're back. I haven't seen you in a few weeks. How you been?
Been good. I've been out and about, diving, working on film sets, running around, doing what we can. But now it's good to be back. I thought when you said we have a new guest on, I thought you're actually going to introduce me. I thought I'd been sacked and reintroduced, but that's cool. I'm here.
Welcome back. Did you not get that email?
No, but hey, speaking of the guest we got, I'm not going to introduce him because I'm going to do a terrible job of it, but I'm excited about this one because he's cross-pollinating between some pretty interesting and dynamic industries. So I'm going to introduce Sean, or Captain Sean Golding. Sean, Captain, how are you? Sean.
Oh, I'm good, thanks, Sonny. How are you going?
What do I call you? Do I call you Captain, Sir, Lieutenant? What do we call you?
I'll answer to Sean. That works pretty much for me. Yeah.
Now, Sean, I'm being cheeky here because you would have to be in a very, very small group of people in Australia where you are a commercial pilot, but you are also a registered paramedic. Am I wrong?
You are right. I am.
Nick, have you ever heard of one of these?
I know a few guys that are paramedics that are also pilots, but when I say pilot, they go and get their Cessna on the weekend. By
I'm not talking about Cessnas.
And fly around. Sean, we're talking about commercial Sean airline pilots.
He drives the big things.
Yeah. Not the biggest, but, you know, it's big enough.
Sean, can you just give us a quick introduction? Who are you? What do you do?
Okay. So my name's Sean Golding, and I work in the airline industry. I've been a captain for 23 years now. Been in the airline industry for about 35. I'm currently an examiner. I'm an instructor trainer and check captain, and I fly the Boeing 787. I've flown a number of airplanes, 747, A330, 767. So I've had quite a varied career so far in aviation.
Now, when you rang me an hour ago just to confirm this chat, you had to shamelessly drop where you just got back from?
Yeah, I spent the day flying over Antarctica yesterday.
Must be nice.
That was a big day out. Yeah.
Fantastic.
What does that entail?
Oh, well, you know, there's quite a bit of flight planning. We go down there for sightseeing. So we've got to work out with the meteorologist where the clear areas of Antarctica are. So that starts a couple of days out. And then we do quite a lot of flight planning and so on. And then the flight down there is about, you know, 4.5 hours. And then we spend 4 hours flying over the ice. And yesterday was a fantastic day. We went down over the Ross Sea and the Transantarctic mountain ranges down to a little place called Mount Erebus, which is at the beginning of the Ross Ice Shelf. Yeah. So, and then we basically do the reverse and come home. And we got in about 10:30 last night.
That's so cool. Do the people who get the aisle seats, do they get a bit dirty about it?
They actually have a pretty good system where they swap over halfway. So you're in the aisle on the way down, then you swap over, and then you're on the window on the way back. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a pretty good system. Works all right.
How good. That's awesome. So you started off as a commercial airline pilot. You did that for quite a number of years and became a paramedic. How did you transition? What happened? Was it that little dirty virus called COVID?
Yeah. No, it was actually before then. I actually was a dive instructor. Well, I still am, but I was a dive instructor and I had a few kind of incidents with some students, and I thought, gee, I better up the first aid skills somewhat. And I was just looking around at the first aid courses thinking, you know what, they're not going to be enough for what I want to do. Hmm. And then I went down a pathway of looking at paramedic courses, and I went and did a diploma. Finished that in 2017, 2018, Then got my hours up, got registration, and I'm just finishing off my degree, the last two subjects now. So that's my journey. It turned out to be the biggest first aid course I've ever done, but anyway, nearly finished.
I'm genuinely curious. I mean, some of the flights that you do, I mean, they could only be described as long haul. I'm actually curious. What is the longest flight that you've actually flown?
So the longest flight I did was back in 2019, where I flew from New York direct to Sydney. And that was over 19 hours. It was 19 hours, 19 and a quarter hours.
And, so 19 hours in the air.
Yeah.
It could only be described in the medical space as what we would call an extreme environment. You are devoid of any kind of infrastructure that's going to actually assist you respond to things. You've got to have medical incidents occur when you're actually flying.
Yeah, we do. We do have medical incidents that occur. We carry what we call a physician's kit. So we've got various drugs on board. We've got various equipment that we can use if need be, and mainly reserved for, you know, doctors or paramedics if they're called. The crew aren't really trained to use that.
Well, this is where I'm genuinely curious, Sean, because you're the captain, you're flying the bird, you're also a paramedic. Now, I've been on flights in the past where they literally, you hear over the intercom, are there any medical professionals on board that can lend assistance? Now, look, I'm a bit cheeky sometimes. I'm one of those people that it depends on where in the movie I'm actually up to, depending on whether I put my hand up. But there's always someone on the flight who's willing to assist, which is a good thing. What do you do when you call, when you get a medical emergency? Do you call for another pilot to come and replace you because you are the paramedic? Can you help me understand?
So,
are there any other pilots on board?
Yeah, look, normally on these really long flights, we carry four pilots. So we have got capacity for someone to leave the flight deck. In fact, normally, you know, apart from the takeoff and the landing, we share it. So there's two off having a break and two on flying, just so that we can get enough rest for those really long flights. So if we've got that augmented crew, I would have capacity to go back. But if there was just the two of us, no, I'm stuck flying. So that's the bottom line. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too often. And most of the stuff that does, it's fairly minor, although, you know, there's been a couple of instances where we've had to intervene a little more.
I'm curious too. I mean, depending, I mean, there's a lot of cost, obviously, in medical incidents in the air too. Is there I'm assuming it's a delicate seesaw between, you know, diverting to another airport to offload a serious case or trying to make do with what you've got on board. Is that something that befalls you as the captain or whoever's responding as the medico to give advice?
Yeah, look, it's actually probably a three-way decision. We would have a clinician on board. If there is a clinician on board, they would provide advice as to what they think the best treatment options for the passenger or the patient would be. From the captain's perspective, we've got to look at the disposition of the airplane, where we are, what are the available airports, what are the risks associated with diverting to a particular airport. But we also consult over our satellite phone to a medical agency in the US who provide in-flight medical support via that phone. So it's usually in conjunction with all three parties that we'd make a decision to divert. Yeah, but you are quite remote. Like, for instance, in Antarctica yesterday, you know, there's a US base down at McMurdo, but apart from that, the nearest airport is somewhat around three and a half to four hours away. That's the closest we've got to get any kind of intervention.
It would have to be a bad incident on board to divert to a base in Antarctica.
Yeah, well,
most people get evac'd out of there.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't actually divert to unless there was something seriously wrong with the airplane. Like, it would be very unlikely because once you're in there, how are we going to accommodate, you know, 250 people is another story.
Interestingly, I mean, you and I have had some really good chats about this, but during COVID, you couldn't fly.
No, I couldn't. In fact, yeah, we only had kind of about a week's notice that the airline was shutting down. So, we basically had to go and scramble and find whatever we could. People did all sorts of things because our kind of job is quite specific with its skill set, and some of the skills you can use elsewhere, but others you can't, obviously. So, yeah, for me, I ended up working as a patient transport paramedic.
How was that this kind of week? Like, you've been flying for almost two decades and you have a reasonably secure job, then, you know, a bit of information comes around that there's this virus and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Then suddenly you are out of the job and have nowhere to take those skills. So how was that for you? In, like,
It was really daunting. Yeah, it was very daunting. You know, you're sort of reassessing your future. You're reassessing your life in terms of even your mortgage. You know, I couldn't pay the mortgage. There was a whole bunch of stuff that you needed to consider. And really, for me, it was trying to get some income and do something that I thought was worthwhile to build a bridge until such time as I could get back flying again. And if that didn't happen, then it was going to be reassessed what I was going to do for a career.
Yeah. 20 so, years of flying to then flying in a patient transport ambulance, that's a big difference. That's a big transition.
It is. But it was necessary. I thought that, you know, it was a worthwhile job for me to do. It needed to be done. I added value to, you know, patients' health and well-being, I think. And I really didn't have an issue with it. Yes, it was a big change from what I was used to doing, but I felt that it was quite a good, worthwhile job to be doing.
Probably in that time, in that era too. I mean, that was probably one of the most important things to be doing. But interestingly, and I mean, this, I find this quite unique too, but yeah, human factors in medicine has been talked about and talked about and talked about, and human factors in paramedicine is kind of starting to creep into discussions. There's a lot of lip service from my experience. And still a lot of old customary things occurring in relation to, I guess, hierarchical control. And we see it time and time again, this hierarchical approach to medicine. It really makes things difficult. It makes situations challenging sometimes for paramedics to actually advocate for clinicians because of this hierarchical problem. You're coming from two completely different industries. One's aviation, one is, well, we'll call it paramedicine. One is still heavily influenced by this hierarchical, almost military structure, and one has been teaching itself lessons for the last 40 years? I'm genuinely curious. You take off a captain's uniform where you are someone important. I mean, I see a captain walk through the airport and I think, man, he must be clever or she must be a genius. But I know so many of our colleagues, because of the way the culture still exists in paramedicine, they don't have that same kind of opinion or approach to patient transport officers, even so that, you know, there's some graduates that I see getting patient transport jobs and they don't value them because they don't value the role because of this hierarchical problem. I'm genuinely curious what your experience was like moving from being a captain in an industry that is heavily influenced by human factors and crew resource management, coming into a different profession in certainly one of the lower categories of that profession that is not influenced by CRM or human factors as it should be.
Yeah, look, I did see a difference in the way the human factors or the non-technical behaviours were applied in paramedicine versus in the airline industry. Having said that, I came across some amazing people, but on the other side of the coin, equally, I had very poor experiences. In fact, I remember one experience I had where I walked into an ICU, and I won't tell you which hospital it was, but one of the nurses came up. I was with my partner. We just had a pickup from an ICU to take. I can't even remember where now, but I walked in, and the first thing that was said to me in reference to the job that we were doing was, is that the best you can do? And I didn't let it worry me. I didn't care less. And then my partner got quite upset and walked over to that nurse and said, why don't you ask him what his other job is? And, you know, the conversation went on, and then the attitude changed. And that for me really highlighted that, you know, some of the treatment that you get is based on what uniform you wear or the perception of the job you do. And so, therefore, they're dismissing potentially a critical component of the team. And we've learnt that lesson in aviation. I mean, back in the late 70s, for example, In fact, one of the world's worst, in fact, the world's worst aviation accident happened in a place called Tenerife back in 1977, where there were many factors on the day that occurred. But on that day, one of the significant factors was the captain's attitude to his crew and the fact that the crew couldn't even speak up, or they had difficulty speaking up when they perceived him to be doing something incorrect. Ultimately, what happened, two 747s collided, and on the runway, they weren't even in the air, and 583 people lost their lives.
Wow.
That was one of those watershed moments in our industry where that was the result of a breakdown of a number of things, mostly non-technical behaviours. But two serviceable 747s killing 583 people is unacceptable. But it's just as unacceptable if the result occurs in one death or one harm to a patient because of a breakdown in these non-technical behaviours.
Doesn't have the same impact as 500 people and two serviceable planes, though, does it? You describe it as a watershed moment.
Yeah, it won't, though. That's the problem, because you won't see one of those events making the headlines. It won't be plastered all over the news. It won't be, you know, seen internationally. It's just, and so nothing happens. And so therefore, you know, and I know that there's some issues with reporting and medical litigation and so on. So that's another area we won't even talk about today, but the fact is that if you have the attitude where you're treating somebody that wears a different uniform, that has potentially a different skill set to you, then your leadership, your teamwork, your communication breaks down. And ultimately, who would suffer from that? Probably the patient.
Nick, it's interesting because you've got someone who's worn a captain's uniform, who's, you know, given that respect in the community, who then puts on something like a PDO uniform in our industry and not given that respect until our own colleagues find out he's a commercial pilot and then attitude changes. You would have seen this in your role. You would have seen the way people treat each other differently depending on the pips on their shoulders, the crowns on their shoulders, the CCP, the MICA badges.
Oh, 100%. It kind of goes both ways as well. Sometimes, the exact scenario that Sean's described, we have someone wearing what is perceived to be a lower rank or doing an inferior job, that their opinions get ignored. And sometimes, especially in a lot of the jurisdictional ambulance services, the men and women who are in those positions are going there after a long career working in acute roles. So they were the paramedics of the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s that did 30 years on the road that now have transitioned to those other roles. So they have a huge wealth of experience and knowledge to offer the next generation of paramedics. But you also see it the other way around, where you see junior staff acting up in middle management positions. And as soon as they put pips on their shoulder or put a level of seniority on their shoulder, they get treated differently by their colleagues because they're part of the management team and not the on-road team anymore. And it changes the relationship, which is pretty disappointing to see. Have you ever seen anything like that happen, Sean? That upwards kind of change?
I have. Yeah, look, I have. I mean, in our industry, you look at people who are quite ambitious, who will take on management roles, and then there's a very different interaction they have with their peers than they were having when they were, you know, in a more junior rank. One of the things, again, it comes back to that teamwork, is that if I've got a crew and I've got a very junior crew member, they might only be wearing two stripes on their shoulder. That doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have any experience. In fact, if I'm making decisions and I'm trying to get their opinion on something, what I will actually do is I'll actually ask the most junior crew member first. Because I don't want to go, this is how we're doing it. I don't want them to agree with me. I want them to challenge me, because they might come up with a better idea than me. And that's when I say that's exactly what I was thinking too. So it makes me look good. But aside from that, if you've also got to, on the flip side of the coin, you've also got to recognize that some of the junior crew members or the junior clinician still have to show that respect to the more senior people in the industry. So it kind of works both ways.
Sean, what needs to change then in the approach in paramedicine? How did aviation flip the script, so to speak?
Yeah, well, it was those significant accidents back in the 70s. There were independent studies done, and really our culture has been shifting since then. I mean, even when I joined the iron industry in 1989, and it's very different now than when it was, but the change comes from the leadership, because the leadership needs to recognise the significance of implementing culture and good non-technical skills into the training and into the everyday practice. And if you don't have an organisation supported by the leadership to make those changes, then it's going to be very difficult to do so.
You just referenced non-technical skills, which I want to latch onto for a second, Sean, because just before we started this discussion, you had a pile of textbooks in front of you because you're finalising some of your paramedical studies in between flying to Antarctica, whatever. But the education that we've all gone through, it's vastly different depending on the era. It's vastly different depending on the geographical location. But I know that my paramedic education was heavily clinical skills focused 10, 15, 20 years ago. It was all clinical skills. I'm going to throw a statistic at you that's made up. 98% of my paramedic education was clinical skills. And now that I'm actually teaching and working in the academic space with Nick, I haven't seen much change. A lot of our focus is on clinical skills, and some that only get used a couple times a year. When what we... my opinion, certainly my observations, what we should be teaching are what I would call non-technical skills, except I've been in trouble for calling it non-technical skills. I used to get in trouble for calling them soft skills. Apparently they're not soft skills because they're quite hard to do. We then called them non-technical skills, but then we got told, no, they're quite technical to do. So I don't know what to call these skills. We'll just call them professional skills. But what are these non-technical skills that you're referring to there?
So non-technical skills is the right term. So there's different terminology. So human factors encompasses non-technical skills, but it also looks at things like fatigue and stress and so on and so forth. But non-technical skills themselves basically describe a set of behaviours. And those behaviours, we break it down into things like situational awareness, decision-making, teamwork, leadership, workload management, communication. So they're some of the non-technical skills we talk about, or sometimes they're referred to as non-technical behaviours or socio-technical skills. Whatever you want to call them, that's what they are. And really, they underpin a lot of the technical skills that we perform. And I always, when I'm teaching in the simulator, one of the things I really try and focus on is using my superior technical, non-technical skills to avoid having to use my superior technical skills.
I was hoping you were going to say non-superior technical skills then, but it's okay.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's because when we started to focus in our industry on improving the non-technical skills, that's when we started to see some big changes in not only safety outcomes, but also culture and behaviour.
What are some examples of non-technical skills that you can apply for both aviation and paramedicine?
Well, things like decision-making, for example. So, looking at options, looking at risk, looking at how I make a decision in terms of things that could affect me. You know, I could say, you know, with decision-making alone, things that are going to affect my perception of a situation. Things like fatigue, stress, you know, potentially alcohol, drugs. Hopefully not, but they do affect you.
Fatigue management and paramed. How's that going?
We're going down another rabbit hole.
Another rabbit
hole. You guys, Sean, you can't fly if you are X amount over. Well, how's fatigue work in the aviation industry?
So we have a fatigue risk management system. So aviation has fairly strict rules around what you can and can't do, how much rest you have, how much time you can spend on duty. And those rules are basically embedded into the roster. If there's any breaches, then you might have to have, you know, this reporting, and there's also extension of rest time just to ensure that you're turning up to work fit and healthy. So, yeah, we do have a very strict fatigue risk management system in place. It's not, in terms of strictness, that prescriptive. It does have some flexibility within it, but we've got a system. And unless you have some kind of fatigue risk management system, then you are going to potentially put your clinicians at risk.
Because our system basically says that if you're too fatigued, you shouldn't work, but operationally, we're going to bully you into still responding. Now, I know I'm being cheeky here. I know I'm sorry, Nick. I know I'm being controversial. I know my own bias is coming out, but there is a big difference between jurisdictional service work and the private sector work, and there is a huge difference in paramedicine in jurisdictional work between working rurally and metropolitan areas. Those who work rurally will know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, Sean, the worst run of shifts I had, I went for nearly 51 hours without stopping because I was the only resource within about 300 kilometers. And so when something would happen every 7 or 8 hours, which isn't busy, we would be called. Even if we were fatigued, we would be called, and they'll say something like, we need you to respond, but we're sending another crew from X town that's going to be 40 minutes away. It would still break your fatigue. And so we literally went for 51 hours without actually stopping properly to recuperate. And this is why we're doing very technical clinical skills. You know, we're not just talking about putting band-aids on people. We're talking about thrombolizing people in lounge rooms or pulling people out of an upside down vehicle on a rural road. There's a system in paramedicine, but it doesn't seem to have the emotional intelligence or leadership yet from above to actually implement it appropriately, because what we are governed by is response times and clocks.
That's the problem. If you want to put in place a system that manages fatigue effectively, it's possibly going to cost you more heads, right? And that means more money.
Cost more money.
So it's going to cost more money, because if you're going to give your clinicians an adequate rest time, so if the paramedics are out there, if you're doing 51 hours, I'd ask you the question, how effective do you think you would be at performing complex tasks and complex decisions with that level of fatigue?
I wasn't even competent enough or have the cognition enough to argue the point and say, I'm not responding. I felt pressured into it, and so I would go. I didn't even have the competence to say, no, I can't. But again, it came back to that culture. But look, part of this recording was I was going to ask you what we need to do in paramedicine to improve, human factors and things like that. Nicky just said it, money.
Well, money makes a difference. And there are some fatigue management systems being implemented now in certain services around trying to manage that and add in more redundancy to allow people who are fatigued to have a bit more of a pause. Yeah. But, it's going to take a long time until we're able to do that. I guess the difference is really is that you know when you're flying versus you don't know when the emergencies are going to come in. So how do you manage something that isn't known?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, and I don't think there's an easy answer for it, but I think it starts again with implementing a good system, recognizing that there are limits and that if you break those limits, then there's going to be certainly some level of decline in your ability. And you have to recognize that that's where, we're talking about making an error. In our we talk about CRM, that term's thrown around a lot, crew resource management. Started out as a term called cockpit resource management, crew resource management. One of the focuses we have now on non-technical skills is actually threat and error management. So threat and error management, you sit there and you think, well, what are the threats? Well, fatigue is one of them. And fatigue can lead to errors. How do I manage that?
You're right.
So good rostering practices, right staffing levels, and so on and so forth. So, threat and error management is a really big thing in aviation. Well, and that's progressed to that. We're up to our sixth version of CRM, if you like, and that is primarily around threat and error management now.
Do you have any rules around sleep inertia? And the reason I ask this, right?
Yeah.
You go to bed, you fall asleep, the pager goes off, you've got a job, And within 5 minutes, depends on where the job is, 5-10 minutes, you've gone from fast asleep to talking to a family, gathering information, making a decision, doing an action, right? Driving a car really fast in the middle of the night. And you've got this kind of sleep inertia around you. Do you guys take that into consideration? And does it affect, is there like a delay between when you wake up and when you're able to be in a position of authority because of that inertia? Yeah. Or how do you manage it?
Yeah, we do. We do. We actually, on these long haul flights, we'll set up a rest schedule. So who's going off for how many hours when? And then we will allow, you know, typically around 15 minutes or so for the wake up call. We come out of our little bunk and put the uniform back on and then walk back into the flight deck. And we're going to have a briefing on what's been happening with the aircraft, where we are in our airspace, any systems, any issues with the passengers. So it's a process that typically takes around 15 minutes, maybe a bit longer.
Hey, Nick, imagine if you got it like that dispatch on the pager or the phone, right? And it's like life-threatening. You're like, cool, I'll be there in 15. I'll be at the ambulance in 15. Man, we got two different. I'm trying to understand how we can improve things like crew resource management, human factors in paramedicine, because like I said, the hierarchical issues exist. But I have never properly given enough credit to how different these two industries actually are as well. Like you said, you can plan your flights. You can't plan your call outs. You can take 15 minutes to wake, put your uniform on, as opposed to you got to be on case in 1 minute.
Yeah. And that's the thing, Sonny, because I do a bit of work up in one of the sim centers at one of the hospitals in Sydney on non-technical skills and human factors. And this sort of stuff comes up. And one of the issues is that what's in aviation is not necessarily a best fit for paramedicine or medicine, because there are differences, and we actually have to recognize that there are differences. So just because we do something in aviation does not mean that it's going to work in paramedicine. We need to actually recognize what those differences are and look at how we can apply the same principles but make it work for you guys. That's the difference. And in terms of how do you fix it, I think it starts with, one, recognizing that you need it, because if you think that non-technical skills training is something that we sort of put on as an afterthought, then you're probably not on the right pathway there. If you think that non-technical skills training is valuable and it should be embedded with everything we do, then, and that's what we do now. So to give you an idea, every training course we do, we embed non-technical skills training. It's actually required by law for us to do that. So the Civil Aviation Safety Authority have published the requirements for training programs, and it's mandated. So we do need to sort of think about, if you're going down that pathway in paramedicine or medicine, that it should form a significant portion of any training program, and the non-technical skills should be embedded in the training programs as well. So if you're doing, like I remember doing one on one of my courses, modules on trauma, so we need to make sure, for example, in the trauma module, we have a fairly decent non-technical skills training program embedded within that, because that's what we want to achieve. If you think about the end goal is to improve the way you practice. And if non-technical skills training is a significant part of that, why isn't it included as much as it should be?
Well, if you look at the percentage of the job role, you know, over half the job is non-technical skills, isn't it, Nick? It's communicating. Yeah. It's rapport building. Yeah. It's reflecting. It's a significant part of what paramedics do, yet most of the education is still heavily focused around clinical skills. But, I mean, I guess you need paramedics to know how to do their clinical skills when the time is called
for. Absolutely.
I think sometimes, and I'd love to get your opinion on this as well, Sonny, I think sometimes we lean towards incorporating a lot of these technical skills into our education because we can objectively measure whether or not someone can do them well or not well. So we can say, yes, they can do it. They get the points, they pass, they move forward in their study, right? Firstly, do you think that's relevant? And secondly, how then do you incorporate assessments into non-technical skills? Is it because it's, you know, is it based on the opinion of the assessor, or do you use certain metrics similar to your technical skills, or how do you do it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Nick. And that's one of the problems we've had, because measuring the performance of technical skills is pretty easy, right? Mm. You've got a set of criteria. If you meet those metrics, you tick the box, you pass. Non-technical skills training is not implemented effectively, I think, mainly because a lot of the instructors and educators don't understand it themselves. So to answer your question in terms of how do you do it, well, we actually will define the competency standards that are required. So we will actually highlight, for example, decision-making. So we will then make a list of all of the effective decision-making competencies that we would expect to see somebody performing in a particular task. And so we don't want to have a subjective assessment. We want an objective assessment, or as objective as it can be, because there's always going to be some level of subjectiveness. So, but if you at least define what it is that you're looking for, it's going to make it a lot easier for you to then measure that. Because non-technical skills, they need to be teachable, they need to be definable, and they need to be measurable. And if we meet those three criteria, we can then start to look at how we can incorporate that into our training programs.
It's so much of what we do. I reckon you can do most jobs with what's between your ears, not what's in your kit.
Yeah. So when we train a new captain, right, most people, by the time they come up to be a captain, can fly an airplane just fine. That generally is not the issue. The issue is what's going on up here, how they're actually performing with their non-technical behaviours or their non-technical skills. That's the stuff that really counts.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that separates someone who's really good from someone who is just able to fly.
Yeah.
And that's what we want to see.
Yeah. It's exactly the same for the critical care training. You do all your technical stuff in the first 2 months, and the rest of the program is all about how you apply it and manage a scene and make decisions and all that. So,
yeah.
Very similar process.
I got one last question for you, Sean.
Go for it.
What is the coolest place that you've flown over?
Oh, gee.
And you can't say Antarctica because we already talked about penguins, so you can't say Antarctica.
Okay. I've flown over a lot of places.
See, he keeps bragging, Nick.
No. I'm just trying to think. I'm just trying to think what it was. I reckon that the Himalayas are pretty spectacular to fly over.
Nick's going there over March.
The Hindu Kush, all that area, flying over that. You know, that is absolutely sensational. But, you know, the whole world's got something different. It's all unique. And I love looking at everything from that perspective up there.
I don't know how you do it. I get lost literally just trying to go down to the beach sometimes. So I don't know how you find North, South America. But anyway, I guess you just
you just go down the back in the cabin. And you know those little maps they've got in the back of the seat there? Just look at that for a while.
Just follow
and
that.
Just go back up, right? Yeah.
Which line are we on?
Have a look at that map.
That's why there's four pilots, Nick.
Yeah. How many pilots does it take to fly a plane? Sounds like a subtle joke.
Sean, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Sonny. And Nick, great to be here, and we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you, Sean. Guys, if you have any questions about today's podcast or a question for Sean, you can reach out to us on our website, www.theshiftextension.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Instagram. But until next time, we'll see you in 2024. Thanks for a great year, Sonny.
Thank you, Nick.
See you next time.